Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, my friends. Happy Monday. I hope you are well. I hope you had a good weekend. If you didn't, don't worry about it. It's over now. Sure, why would we stress about that? I am Louise McSherry. This is Catch Up with Louise McSherry. And the Monday episode is always a news catch up. And I've been getting messages ever since Leo Varadkar announced that he was going to be resigning from people saying, oh God, I need people to, I need this to be explained. There's not a whole lot to explain, but we do, of course, get into that here. We also get into the other stories of the news over the last week or so. Just a little reminder that there will be a new culture episode on the Patreon this week. Every month I pick a kind of TV program or a movie or sometimes a musician or could be anything in the realm of culture and discuss it with a contributor. And I have just confirmed that this week we are going to be talking about Oprah's two-part program on Ozempic. Which is obviously relevant to my interest. She has just done this TV program in America, and there has been so much discussion about it over the course of the weekend. And Oprah herself and her role within diet culture and, the way she has gone to bat for various different diets and other weight loss methods over the years and the impact that has had on people. And I simply cannot stop thinking about it. And so myself and James O'Hagan, who you know, of course, from the entertainment slot, who we adore, are going to have watch the program and have a chat about it for the Patreon this week. So if you're into that, do come over and join. Don't forget that if you do join the Patreon, you can listen to all the previous culture episodes and all the mailbag episodes. And, you know, most importantly, you will be supporting this podcast and meaning that I can continue to do it hopefully long into the future. So patreon.com/catchupwithlouisemcsherry. Now though, let's get into the news. Carl Kinsella, you are once again coming to us from a study vestibule in, where is it? Is it in a library?
It is in a library, yeah. And I mean, it might sound like it's in a cave. if the listeners can pick up the echoing.
Yeah.
But no, I'm just in a normal old library study room. I've got a crazy hectic week this week. My study, like, I'm kind of in the home stretch of the master's now. So
yeah,
kind of have to, be in the study environment as much as possible.
Yeah, so just in case you haven't listened to this episode before, Carl lives in Amsterdam at the moment because he's been doing a master's in, what's the official name again, Carl?
It's New Media and Digital Culture is the official name of the master's. And I'm nearly done.
He's nearly done. Which means he's living in the library. So we're recording. He's in like a little room in the library, study room. It is quite echoey. And unfortunately, Carl's laptop decided to pack it in on him just for no reason a couple of weeks ago. So he's got a temporary laptop that's not recognizing his microphone. Kind of the world is against us. And yet still we can hear each other. And we're going to do this because, let's be honest, if there has been a week that people need to hear an explanation of what's going on, this is probably it.
Yeah, absolutely. What a week it's been. I feel like, I think it was only 2 weeks ago, you and I were talking about something else. I think maybe it was talking about the movement of the international protection order people. Mm. And we were talking about something Leo Varadkar had said. And you said something like, fuck off, Leo Varadkar. And now he's gone.
I actually thought about that over the last week. I was like, oh my God. Because I was having a conversation with Gordon about... I said to him, I was like, I can't get into this Leo stuff. And he was like, as if it's a book or a film or something. And he was like, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't feel the same passion that people seem to have when they talk about Leo Varadkar. I don't have the kind of passionate dislike or... I mean, I think some people hate him is the truth, is the fact of the matter. And I don't have that. Like, I kind of think he probably was doing his best from his position. He, I think, genuinely thought he was doing the right thing in every, virtually every circumstance. Like, I just don't agree with him on lots of things. And my fuck off Leo was not like a, I'm going to come and stand outside your house and ruin your life, fuck off Leo. It was just like, don't say stupid things like that, Leo.
You weren't like telling him to get out. You weren't telling him to resign.
No.
You weren't instructing him to do what he's now done.
No, I wasn't. I suppose I kind of am probably like empathetic to an actual fault, because I always find myself just being like, I know, but that would be very hard. Like one time I sat beside Leo in a box at a Lizzo concert because I was brought by a guest of someone who's very well connected, or I was a guest of someone who's very well connected. And it was amazing. And it was kind of weird to be like in a box with Leo Varadkar. We didn't talk at all. But at the end of the concert, like loads of people who were down on the floor of the Olympia just turned around and just started roaring abuse up at him. And I couldn't help but feel like, ah, lads, really? Like, is this right? Is it right that he can't go anywhere? And I don't know the answer to that question, because there are people who I really like and I really respect who would argue that, yeah, it is right. And I'm not, you know, I'm not firmly on one side of the equation, but just on a human level, I was like, he's just trying to enjoy the music of Lizzo. You know?
Yeah. And like, obviously, his legacy certainly will be as a music fan. I feel like the Kylie Minogue letter is also one of the main things people have been remembering this week.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of cringe there, let's be honest.
Yeah, a lot of cringe, a lot of decisions, and a lot of, I think in Leo Varadkar's case, a lot of statements that bother people. I think what often, because I mean, Leo Varadkar, like all Fine Gael TDs, he's a functionary of an ideology. He's a representative of what Fine Gael believe. So, I mean, and I think as people are about to discover, it doesn't really matter who the leader of Fine Gael is. Fine Gael are Fine Gael.
Yeah.
They were Fine Gael under Endicenny, they were Fine Gael under Garrett Fitzgerald in the 80s. Yeah. They are Fine Gael. They have a neoliberal economic point of view. They can be pushed towards social progress by the public if the public is kind of strong enough on it. I don't think much of that is going to change under new leader Simon Harris, who we'll get to. But I think as far as how the people feel about Leo Varadkar and why there is sort of a lack of empathy towards him is because, I mean, you know, he has never come across as a very sympathetic individual outwardly. Yeah. You know, I think when he has been called into action and in the Dáil, asked to comment on matters like, for example, welfare fraud or homelessness or unemployment during the pandemic, you know, he's often found wanting because he doesn't seem to have that natural level of human compassion. And, you know, and maybe he does. I don't know Leo Varadkar personally, but I think, you know, watching from the outside for the last 7 years, I've always found him yet to be, he's, you know, for my tastes, even, you know, I don't agree with Fine Gael's ideology, but even with that aside, he never displayed the kind of empathy that I would like from
him. There's a warmth missing, I think. I would not disagree with that whatsoever. Like I met him, like one time I properly met him because he was opening a function that I was speaking at, and it was with a load of teenage girls basically. I was surprised by how unable he seemed to be to kind of join in, and like, you know, I felt like I had to manage all of the social interactions, and I was like, hang on, you are literally the Taoiseach, surely you should be good at this, but no.
That's when you consider that, like, I feel like Endicani and even Micheál Martin, these guys have such reputations for, like, glad handing and being able to work the room. Leo Varadkar is not able to do that. Likewise, I've been in a room with him multiple times. He doesn't have that same kind of way with people at all. And for me, it's surprising that Fine Gael kind of have loved him for so long. You know, and even now he's leaving on his own terms. It's not as if he's been ousted. There was no stab in the back, as he said himself. He's leaving, you know, just because, you know, there's a good report in the journal from Christina Finn, the political editor at the journal. She would have been in Washington, D.C., in Boston with Leo last week during his trip for St. Paddy's Day. And she was saying that, you know, you can feel a lack of energy from him and that he doesn't seem as enthusiastic about the job as he once did. So it's not the fact that, you know, they've decided they've outgrown him, Fine Gael. It feels like almost he maybe has outgrown them. So it's a very strange dynamic. I do think, you know, I want to come in and say, you know, a lot of political correspondents this week have called for, you know, people to sort of be, you know, to set criticism aside for a week in terms of respecting the ceremony of things. I think that's the kind of attitude that probably gets a lot of backlash because, I mean, there's no bereavement here. You know, it's you know, Leo Varadkar, he was emotional when he gave his goodbye speech, but he's not, you know, there's nothing to really worry about. And I think it's totally fair now going into this new
era. He hasn't died. He's not sick. Like, he's an adult man who's made a choice about his career.
Totally. So I think it's still fair to reflect on, you know, record levels of homelessness and record levels of waiting lists in hospitals. I think, you know, none of that needs to be swept under the rug. And I think it's fair enough that people are critical in this moment. But yeah, you know, I suppose the thing to talk about now is a new era of Fine Gael, which is kind of, it is a shock to everyone. Nobody, last week, I don't think anybody would have suspected that this is where we'd be, but here we are now. Simon Harris set to be confirmed as the Taoiseach.
So Simon Harris set to be confirmed as the Taoiseach, which is interesting. Interesting that some of the people who maybe people might have expected would come forward and put themselves forward for leader of the party didn't. No Simon Coveney, none of the other of senior ministers stepped forward. So Simon Harris essentially was uncontested as leader of Fine Gael, right?
That's it. He cakewalked it. It was really quite strange. Like, I think in the shock aftermath of Leo announcing that he'd be stepping down, people immediately were counting up, you know, you've got all these heavyweights like Pascal Donoghue, who's been talked about as, like, you know, the new head of the IMF. You have Simon Coveney, who challenged Leo Varadkar for leadership last time in 2017. Helen McEntee has had a good portfolio for a long time. And obviously we've never had a female Taoiseach, so that, you know, was something that people would have looked at as well. Heather Humphreys is very senior. But ultimately, almost right away, every Fine Gael parliamentarian just threw their weight behind Simon Harris. Before he even announced he wanted to be leader, people were saying that he was the man for the job. So Fine Gael are clearly quite unified behind Simon Harris. And the response to his speech, his first leader speech yesterday, was quite a strong one. I don't know if you saw the speech. Personally, I found it quite, you know, cringe in many parts. There was a bit where he was talking about Sinn Féin having the tricolour over the coffin of convicted Garda murderer Piers Macaulay last week. And Simon Harris kind of just went into turbo mode and he started shouting, you know, take our flag back. We want to take our flag back. And it was really like,
Who are we taking our flag back from? Sinn Féin?
So in this case, Sinn Féin.
I mean, I would like to take our flag back because I think it's been absolutely commandeered and co-opted by so-called patriots who are actually racists from the far right. But like, that would be, I would be more emotive about that than...
For sure. And I think this tells you, this kind of take our flag back from Sinn Féin energy that he had in the speech, it tells you where they're first, like where they're looking at first. They're not looking at sort of, for example, there was a huge march in Coolock yesterday.
Yeah, I saw it.
Really disturbing videos online of children chanting, get them out. It's awful. And it's unfortunate, but Fine Gael are not going to be focusing on that. They're going to be focusing on the political reality in front of them. They have a general election. You know, it can't be more than 11 months away. February 2025 is the latest it can be. So it's going to be soon. And, you know, their focus is on beating Sinn Féin. And unfortunately, it's not about what I, and I think you, Louise, would consider to be like the health of the country in terms of taking action against these, you know, local anti-immigration groups.
You have to wonder, like, if... Now, I'm not a political expert, obviously. That goes without saying, even though I just said it. But you have to wonder if the right strategy is to kind of go in all guns blazing, bolshy like that. You know, if you're concerned about an electorate, a young electorate who are moving more and more towards Sinn Féin, who feel like Sinn Féin represents them, is it the right thing to go in and just like start slagging them off in that way? Like, surely it would be better to kind of try and see where they're winning and then improve your policies in that area. I don't know. That just feels to me like you're going to alienate people who feel, you know, positive towards Sinn Féin.
Well, that's, as someone who kind of has been covering the dynamic between Fine Gael and Sinn Féin for years now, like, my theory on it has always been that the big part of the reason why Sinn Féin have, you know, exploded in the polls and become so much more popular is because there's such dissatisfaction with Fine Gael. Mm. And Fine Gael keep identifying Sinn Féin as the opposite of Fine Gael. So every time Fine Gael do that, people think, okay, well, that's what I'm going to vote for then.
It seems like that's all it's doing. It doesn't feel like that's working for them. So I do question it. And I also, like, Simon Harris, I just don't know if it suits him to do that kind of politicking. Like, I think, you know, he wins on being a human being in a way that maybe Leo Varadkar is not. Like, he posted up an Instagram post, I think it was, you know, with his kids and saying that, like, you know, my most important role in life, no matter what happens over the next few days, is, you know, father to my children. And I, you know, basically care about the future because of them. And I need to make sure that Ireland is a good place for them to grow up in. And I was like, actually, that's quite effective, because that makes you think, okay, no, he does care about the future. He is invested in the things that concern young people and, you know, what kind of country you're creating for future generations. Like, that is, seems like, okay, grand. You could see people maybe going, well, maybe this guy's all right. But then to the all guns blazing approach with Sinn Féin just feels, yeah, it just feels counterproductive to me. I, by the way, have no allegiance to any particular political party, just observing from a kind of analytical standpoint.
Same here, just in case anyone was wondering. Also unaffiliated. Mm. But yeah, I think you're so right. Like, that used to be how Simon Harris framed himself, particularly during Repeal the Eighth when he was Minister for Health.
Yeah.
He really framed himself as a man who was all about, you know, kindness in politics. He really was part of that wave. And he's different now, for sure. That isn't really what he goes for as much, because he had time there when Helen McEntee was pregnant and on maternity leave. Simon Harris was acting Minister for Justice.
Yeah.
And he sort of took that opportunity to sort of try to come across a bit tougher. And I think that sort of changed him. There was one particular exchange I actually had with him on drug policy, where I was interviewing him and I asked him, you know, because he wanted kind of criminal sanctions for people who use drugs recreationally, but a health-led approach for people who are addicts. But of course, the line between those things, as far as I'm concerned, is very fuzzy. You know, you're not, it's, you know, you could be, it's not as if you're just one or the other in many cases. And I put that to him and he sort of just ignored my question. He just sort of rejected the premise. He said he didn't think the line was fuzzy. And I could tell, you know, behind his eyes, I was like, you know that I'm right. Like, you know what I mean. And I just think he's had to toughen up in order to get to this place. Mm. And I think you're toughening up is when you're someone who likes an empathy-led approach, it's not really what you want to see.
No.
You don't want toughness. You want understanding and compassion. But I think based on what other Fine Gael TDs have said, they've been talking about getting back to the core values, saying Michael Rings that Fine Gael have been too left for too long. If anyone thinks Fine Gael is left, they're absolutely off their rocker.
Yeah.
So I think they're definitely going to be pivoting more towards the centre, more towards the right, and more towards this idea of toughness, tough on crime, law and order. And I think, it's going to be an interesting, I think, new era for Fine Gael. And maybe not a fun one for the rest of us.
Yeah, geez. Worth acknowledging that there have been several TDs and indeed ministers who've said that they don't plan on going for their seat in the next election. Josepha Madigan is the most recent one. She's resigned as a junior minister. There is this question of when a general election is going to happen. Lots of people pushing for it to happen sooner because they say that they didn't choose, you know, Simon Harris as Taoiseach. But, like, nobody chooses anyone as Taoiseach. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not how our electoral system works.
That is kind of the truth of the matter. Yeah, it's like, obviously there's some nuance to it in that if you vote for Fine Gael ahead of a general election and you know who their leader is, you're kind of de facto, like, voting for it. But ultimately, yes, like, when Leo Varadkar was made Taoiseach, you know, that there was, it took 3 years for us to have a general election after that.
Yeah.
So these things like aren't super unusual. And like, that is how the system works. But at the same time, I do sort of understand it. Like, just
on a
purely emotional level, it just feels like there's no way that Simon Harris should be leader of the country without me getting a say in it.
Yes.
You know, I should be allowed to go to the ballot and express my take on that. But we will be having one soon. As I said, the latest we can have it is February next year. Mm. It's not going to be before June. We have the European and local elections coming up. So I it would just be mayhem if they announced a general election before that.
Yeah.
They can't really do that.
Okay,
I'd say it could end up being... I think it could be a few months before the February, but it also can't be at Christmas.
Okay.
So if you want my take on it, I think we could have a general election somewhere between September and November, or in January and February.
Get down the bookies. I'm sure this is the kind of thing they take bets on. I'm only messing. Yeah. I absolutely do not encourage gambling, by the way. That is a joke. Okay, well, there will be so much for us to discuss between now and then in terms of how things are going to happen or what's going to happen. But basically, in short, the abridged version is Leo Varadkar left. There doesn't seem to be any kind of weird, gross, you know, sacrilegious reason for that.
Yeah.
It does seem to be his heart wasn't in it anymore, and Simon Harris is expected to be the new Taoiseach when the Dáil returns. They're on their Easter break at the moment, right?
Yeah, they're on their Easter recess, which I just think is, you know, like, obviously every job in the world deserves breaks, but I do find it funny that the Dáil has a break for Easter. I don't know why. Something about Easter is like amusing to me.
Well, I find it funny, and I also think, like, is this not the kind of thing that you would maybe just come back for and just do like a for day sure. or two or on it
seems like
it
seems,
you know,
kind of like an emergency.
Literally the you know, ostensibly the leader of the country, are, you know, apparently the leader of the country is no longer in it, and we're just gonna wait it out until, like, it's crazy. Like, our country is nuts. Okay, well, we'll park that. So Kate Middleton, I have to say, I was really glad that we did not go in on, you know, big on this podcast around the stories about Kate Middleton that have been flying around over the past couple of months when people were wondering where she was. And I know that a lot of people feel really, really awful about the fact that they participated in this kind of chat, because of course it has been revealed that Kate Middleton has been dealing with a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale for people, isn't it?
It is,
you know,
yeah.
Because it's, you know, Kate Middleton herself, you know, gave this, I mean, a video was published last week where Kate Middleton spoke into the camera.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London. And at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment.
We don't know too much more about, you know, prognoses and things like that, but that's kind of, we can leave all that to one side, because I feel like what matters here is that, yeah, there has been a very kind of harsh lesson dealt to, you know, I think not just people on social media, also, you know, whoever is running the PR at Kensington Palace.
Yes.
Like, they have absolutely left Kate Middleton out to dry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just seems like everything about how she's speaking about the diagnosis, it feels like she's been left to coordinate this response on her own.
Yeah.
You know, when that image came out of her and the three children, and she was the one who had to give the excuse of making edits on her phone. Like, you know, all of this mystery and all of this lack of information, this vacuum that has been allowed to take place, it's very, you know, it's sadly inevitable that, like, social media has tens of millions, if not billions, of users, any given social media platform. Not all of those people are going to behave appropriately.
Mm.
And when you have, you know, conspiracy theories and things flying off the handle, you know, you need the person with authority to come out and say, here's what's happening.
100%. Like, I don't understand why they didn't just come out and say, she's sick.
She's sick.
She's sick.
Yeah, you know,
that's it. She's sick. Yeah. We can't provide you with any more information at the moment, but she is sick. Shut the fuck up. Like, that should have been the line. I mean, obviously not in those words, but, like, it's crazy to me that they allowed it to go and go and go and spin and spin and spin. And I suppose this is consistent with everything that we've heard now because of Harry about the way the kind of PR offices within, and they all have their own individual PR offices and communications offices as members of the royal family. Then there's the overall, you know, communications office. And, like, Harry has consistently said that, you know, those all work against each other and are an absolute mess. And they are in kind of at times in cahoots with the British press. And like, it just feels so nasty that Kate is the victim of all of this.
Yeah. And that's, as you said, like people feel guilty, but yeah. ultimately the royal family does not deserve any of the benefit of the doubt. So when the mystery happens, you know, people are thinking of Diana, they're thinking of the way Meghan Markle has been treated, they're thinking of the way Prince Andrew has been sheltered. So when they sense secrecy from the royal family, they don't give the benefit of the doubt, which is totally fair yeah. because the royal family has absolutely expended all of their benefit of the doubt. Mm. And so, like, you know, there is some degree of sympathy for the people who were, you know, making jokes and blah, 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 because when you truly don't know, I think your mind doesn't necessarily assume that it is going to be the worst case scenario.
No.
I think a lot of people just assumed that it was the royal family misbehaving.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately, that is why in this day and age, in the media landscape we live in, people need information.
Yeah.
People need the right information. And if it's hidden from them, unfortunately, we are kind of staring into a bit of an abyss.
Yeah. Now, I suppose, like, you know, one of the complications in this situation is that Kate, of course, is a mother of three children. And, you know, when I was diagnosed with cancer 8 years ago, telling people was actually one of the hardest bits. I didn't know at the time that in the end it would be one of the hardest bits, but because I was very lucky and my treatment was quite straightforward and it worked and I'm fine. You know, looking back, I remember kind of being on the phone and having to say like the words, "I have cancer," to my dad is the one that I remember being particularly like, you, because he was one of the first people I told. Like, it was really difficult because I hadn't processed it yet. So I cannot imagine having to have that conversation with your children. Like, that is another level. And I genuinely don't know how, and people have to do it all the time. And I had like kind of a semi argument with someone on Twitter because I expressed empathy for her in this situation. And they were like, "Well, she's so privileged. She has privilege. She's blah, blah, blah." In fairness, they were much more reasonable than that. But they were like, you know, "She'll have access to childcare. She'll have access to this, to that date. You know, she'll have an easier ride." And I was like, yes, all of those things are true, but none of that is a comfort when you're sitting down face to face with your children and you have to tell them that you have cancer. Like, that's not going to help you. Your privilege isn't going to help you in that situation. So as a human being, I really kind of feel for her. And I can imagine that until they had a clear picture of what was going on, maybe they didn't want to say anything because they didn't want things getting back to the children until they could tell the children what was going on. Like, you know, you're talking about human emotions here and it is complicated. Like, it's not simple. And to be honest, I like, obviously Kate is the one that you feel for the most at the end of the day, because for whatever reason, whether it was the PR team's decision or her decision in terms of whether she could speak or not, or whether it should be spoken about or not, like, she has had to endure this horrible experience of being diagnosed with cancer. She's had to endure the reality of telling her family that she has cancer. And she's had to do it all while people are talking the craziest shit about her all around the world. Like, it's not great.
No, and especially when, I mean, it feels like she has been left so alone.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't feel like that. When you think about the enormity of Buckingham Palace, what a huge operation it is.
Yeah.
You just think that there should, I mean, you would assume that if you were to fall ill while in the sort of the care of Buckingham Palace and Kensington Palace, that you would be supported. And, you know, that is just not the impression I think anyone has gotten from the last 3 or 4 months. It feels like she's been very alone.
Yeah.
And you know, we just kind of have to wish her all the best and hope that she has a speedy and successful recovery.
Absolutely. I really would love someday if we got to hear from her, excuse me, in a frank way about her experience of being part of this family, because I can't imagine she would have a lot to say in the positive column.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, moving on. Of course, things continue in Gaza, unfortunately. Things are not improving for the people there. It's worth noting that there was another absolutely enormous pro-Palestinian demonstration in Dublin over the weekend, which is, you know, continues to be heartening. But unfortunately, starvation continues.
Yeah, thousands of people in Dublin this week, which is, as you say, like Ireland's sort of commitment to supporting Gaza has been great. And there is also steps now. I think it is being considered by the Irish government. Sort of behind the scenes, alongside, I think, the Spanish, Slovenian, and possibly the Maltese government to recognize the state of Palestine, which would be a huge step forward. And I actually saw a lot of commentary online this week from people from Palestine who were like very pleased by that news. And stuff like that, like it does give you strength, and it kind of heartens you to know that, like, you know, there are decisions we can make in Ireland that do mean something to the people of Palestine. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on. But yeah, certainly for the moment, things are just awful. Famine is the case in Gaza. You've just got over a million people now starving. Aid is not getting in. The US are building this pier, but they've clarified that they don't really know how they're going to use the pier. So it's in Gaza's two northern governorates, 300,000 people remain trapped, famine expected to arrive between now and May. Mm. And that 1.1 million people in Gaza have completely exhausted their food supplies. So that is that's the information from the US. UN's Human Rights Commissioner, Antonio Guterres, who is the Secretary General of the UN, he's in the Middle East at the moment, and he's doing Ramadan. He's fasting for Ramadan in solidarity. I saw this week that even U.S. political commentators, people on the center right, they were feeling sickened by some of the activity that we've seen in the West Bank. So we talked about this a bit before. Gaza is on the west coast of the Palestinian territory, the West Bank is actually further east. It's called the West Bank because it's west of something else. But it's on the eastern side of the Gazan territory, or the Palestinian territory. And some of the violence that has been happening there this week, and as we say, this is not the area that's controlled by Hamas, with people being displaced, people being shot. There's been videos online this week of people being shot in cold blood, being removed from their homes. And even the kind of center-right politicians in the US are feeling, you know, they're saying that arms should be cut off to Netanyahu for this, because it's just so, it's such an egregious breach of human rights. But of course, what have we seen for the last 6 months but egregious breaches of human rights? The reports this week of systemic sexual abuse against Palestinian women by the IDF, even taking place in Al-Shifa Hospital, which is being attacked again in the last couple of days. So definitely, the details that are coming out of Gaza this week are as bad as ever. And it's worth remembering that we're getting fewer details because there are fewer people there to report them.
Yeah, because so many journalists have been killed.
So many journalists, and even just, you know, kind of citizen journalists, just people with smartphones. There's just fewer of them because, as you say, so many have been killed. So it's, you know, we don't even necessarily know the extent of how bad it is. But certainly for what we can tell, it's as bad as it's been.
Yeah. And, you know, that sexual abuse, when those reports are coming out, you kind of have to wonder how the people who were so up in arms and rightly angry at initial reports of sexual abuse by members of Hamas at the start of this, which were later debunked. You know, people were so upset and angry about that and used that as justification for what was going on, you know, from the Israeli side. You know, will they have that same passion and anger now that we're hearing, you know, more solid reports of sexual violence inflicted on the Palestinian people? It's just heartbreaking. Like, I can't believe that it's still happening. And I think that loads of us are in the same boat. You have to wonder where it's going, because if, as you say, even people who are, you know, toward the right in politics in America are acknowledging at this point that this is beyond the pale, that this is inappropriate and what's happening is wrong, how much longer can America hold out? Can Joe Biden hold out in his support of Netanyahu and what's happening, you know, when Netanyahu is acting like a genuine psychopath? You know, I can't see how this is going to end.
Yeah, and not to heighten the anxiety, but like from November onwards, we could be looking at a Trump in the White House, and Gaza. Joe Biden has already been so, you know, so vociferous and such a strong ally of Israel. Mm. Trump will be even more so and even more reckless. Mm. And that's not it's not me defending Joe Biden. I'm just saying that it can get even worse, and it might well do. So as you say, like it's very hard to see where this goes. It doesn't feel like it's going anywhere positive. You know, you hear from Israeli politicians, like they openly talk about settling the territory. They talk about, you know, building huge properties. They talk about essentially just, you know, the only word for it is colonizing it, colonizing it and building it up as sort of a metropole for what they already have.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, that seems to be where it's going. Mm. And I'll, you know, the world just needs to keep, you know, come together to, like, there needs to be a proper policy shift. And it doesn't feel like that's coming from the US. Maybe we'll see something from the EU, but it certainly hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Moving on, there was an attack in Russia this week, which I think lots of people will have heard about, but maybe don't know what actually happened. So let's go over the nuts and bolts of that.
Yes, so this was an attack in one of Moscow's biggest sort of concert venues. It was in the Crocus City Hall. And there was, I think there was maybe even 1,000 people gathered there, but over 130 people were shot by four gunmen who entered the concert hall, and then they set it on fire. As it turns out, the four gunmen are four men of Tajikistani descent, and ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. ISIS went on Telegram, and they provided like details. They had non-published knowledge, so it's been seen as fairly credible that ISIS are responsible. Because in the immediate aftermath, people were thinking, you know, scratching their heads. They were like, "Oh, is this part of the Ukraine-Russia war? Has Ukraine orchestrated this attack?" But it seems fairly credible that this was ISIS. And to be fair, ISIS have had certain activities lately, like they also committed a bombing in Iran a couple of months ago. Mm. So obviously we all kind of probably remember ISIS from, they had a kind of a heyday in 2014, 2015, and then also committed a lot of string of sort of random stochastic terroristic attacks in the EU, kind of a bit like the Ariana Grande bombing in Manchester. That was, you know, kind of ISIS inspired in 2017. Mm. So it's, but this seems to be kind of a new version of ISIS that seems to be more mercenary. It doesn't seem to be entirely as clear what they want. It just seems like they're carrying out attacks. But yeah, in this case, I was actually talking to a Russian woman on Friday evening as it happened, and she was saying that she was less nervous about the original attack and more nervous about what Putin might do in response. Mm. And Putin has said that the only thing that will come for the men who carried this out are retribution and oblivion. They've all been arrested. They've all shown up in court. A lot of them have like physical, I think they've been beaten pretty badly in custody. So I think, yeah, these men are going to suffer greatly for what they've done. But yeah, it's strange. It's because it's ISIS, it's kind of unclear what impact this will have on the sort of geopolitics. You know, if it was Ukraine, I think we would kind of all be a bit more up in arms and worried about what will come next.
But, well, what I think is interesting is that the US had actually warned Putin that an attack might be imminent just 3 days before the attack. This is according to the journal.ie. Just 3 days earlier, Putin had publicly dismissed a US warning of an imminent attack in Moscow as propaganda designed to scare Russian citizens. They had warned on the 7th of March that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow to include concerts, saying that, you know, caution was needed over the following 48 hours. But Putin says it called it a provocative statement, outright blackmail to intimidate and destabilize our society. So
it's a strange dynamic because I can't remember if we actually discussed this last week, but Putin just very recently won re-election in Russia with like 99% of the vote.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not a free or fair election at all, but
no.
He's just kind of started a new term. So the plan is for him to be there for, at least another 5 years.
Mm.
But Russian people, I think right now, much like with Israelis and Netanyahu, they don't really trust Putin to keep them safe.
Mm.
So it's kind of curious to see now what will happen with respect to like domestic activity. Will there be protests? Will there be some kind of concerted movement against Putin? It's with someone who is an autocrat and a dictator and someone who just makes their own decisions, it's always hard to know what they'll do next. So we can't sit here and think, oh, well, Putin will do this next. But we can imagine that this will certainly inflame tensions in Russia, probably from all angles.
Yeah, okay, let's come back to Ireland. And this was a story about a woman who spoke in court recently about an experience she had in her home with her son. And she used it as an opportunity to talk about psychiatric services in Ireland, which I think she was right to do. Give us just the baseline. This is not a pleasant story, unfortunately, guys. But I think it is worth mentioning what she had to say.
Yeah, this is a woman, I'll give her name. Her name is Mary Coughlin, and her son is being charged with attempted murder in Central Criminal Court in Cork. But her son, 32 years old, he has schizophrenia. He's been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And the mother was not aware of this condition, I believe. Is that right? Or not aware of the diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
She
was aware of the diagnosis, but she didn't. She was never told, or it was never indicated to her that
the
it
risk,
could result in this kind of behavior.
Yeah, and so it's something we've talked about before, Louise. Like a lot of different areas of the Irish state, kind of a lack of joined up thinking. But yeah, Ms. Coughlin, she gave a speech, and she said that. That the lack of information given to her about her son's illness put her in an unexpected, dangerous situation where she endured a horrific assault that almost cost her life and will impact her life forever. And she doesn't blame her son at all. And, I think anyone who has had experience of mental illness understands that mental illness is something that it's not you. It's not who you are.
Mm.
It's something that, can bring about these terrible behaviors and terrible consequences.
Mm.
And she was saying that if she could meet with her son now in a safe environment, she would give him a big hug and tell him that they all love him and acknowledge that the illness was the cause of this. But of course, all of that comes back to her point that it's the illness that needs to be taken seriously by the Irish state and that, we need to have proper care in place for people who might pose a risk due to their illness.
Yeah.
Ms. Coughlin, she suffered like really serious injuries. She was found in a pool of blood in her own kitchen.
Yeah.
Really tragic.
Yeah.
And, for me, like I've had plenty of experience, myself, family, friends, mental illness. And it's very relatable. I've never been in such a violent situation before myself, but people who don't receive the care they need are more likely to pose a risk either to themselves or others or to be at risk.
Mm.
You are also at huge, if you're someone who is schizophrenic and you're not receiving the proper care or you don't have the proper network around you and people aren't being informed, you're at risk of violence because you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
It's something that I think I agree. I think it is good that this woman spoke out about it. Legally, it's quite interesting. Geroid Coughlin, he is actually trying, he doesn't want to be sent to, like in many cases, someone would be sentenced to psychiatric care rather than sentenced to prison. He actually wants to go to prison. He would prefer to go to prison. And of course, these are decisions that people can make for all sorts of reasons.
She spoke about her experience. His struggles with schizophrenia began when he went to college. He was admitted over 10 years, 11 times to the psychiatric unit at Cork University Hospital. She said, "My experience with the mental health services is that it appears effective in certain crises when an immediate threat to life or limb is present, but it falls short in treating mental health conditions and preventing crises, particularly in schizophrenics, where patients often resist medication due to the nature of the disease and their lack of insight." And she said she was frustrated that mental health services allow people with paranoid schizophrenia to live in communities. And then she says, without the care they need to stay well, specifically by sticking to their medication. And that's the crux of it. She's not saying that she thinks that all people who have paranoid schizophrenia should be locked up, but she's saying if you don't offer these people the appropriate care and if you don't make sure that they're staying medicated because their illness will tell them to stop taking their medication, then, you know, it's not safe. And, you know, this is a real tragedy for this entire family, for her son, who has not been cared for appropriately, you know, who should never have gotten into this situation in the first place. And, you know, it feels to me like our mental health system is like emergency based and is really about, you know, solve, like, kind of patching up problems as they happen, and doesn't work as an overall kind of strategic process for really treating people and helping people to be well consistently. You know, even just the fact that you can't access, or it's so difficult to access, like, talk therapy, you know, is like, that's crazy. Like, that's the very basics.
When I was reading this article, I think one of the first things that came to my mind was, like, wouldn't it be great if this was where Simon Harris chose to start? Mm. Like, if you know, if his first kind of initiative was an attempt to bolster and increase funding and properly develop a mental health care strategy in Ireland. Mm. I think that's the kind of thing that would just benefit everybody. I don't think anybody would be against it.
No.
You know, and it would just be, and we are, like, we've discussed this before on the podcast, like, we are just at such a level where there's so little care, and access to care is so so hard to come by, that even kind of small iterative improvements, I think, would be appreciated. Like, yeah, if we could just see every 6 months that we're hiring more consultants and, you know, getting more access to healthcare, that would be great. So I don't know if that's on Simon Harris's agenda.
Yeah.
I know he's a guy with I know he does have, like, a, you know, a background in being Minister for Health, and he kind of got into politics because his brother Adam, he leads that autistic charity, or the charity for autism, as I am.
Yeah.
And, like, he, you know, he's an absolutely fantastic campaigner, Adam Harris.
He is. Yeah.
So yeah, it would be nice if Adam's influence could trickle into Simon Harris's leadership.
It would.
I suppose we'll see.
Now, I wanted to finish on this. We don't have to talk about it for long, but it's just, things are so bleak at the moment. It would be very easy to feel completely bogged down in negativity. And I really do look for stories that kind of try and temper that a little bit. And I was relieved to hear this. And I'll let you bring it in, Carl. Bring us the good news.
Yeah, so this is good news. You know, this week, the Economic and Social Research Institute, the ESRI, they published details on a study they'd done on how Irish people en masse regard immigration. And, you know, you might think that because you see, like, dozens of people with flags, you know, with their faces covered, marching up and down different parts of Ireland, that we have totally shifted, that we're now, like, a country, an anti-immigration country. We're not. The ESRI study showed that 76% of Irish people, which is, you know, over three quarters, it's a landslide, are supportive of helping asylum seekers, and 87% are supportive of helping Ukrainians. Being refugees. So 87%, you know, you're looking almost at 9 out of 10 people. So you're kind of looking at, you know, just an overwhelming majority.
Mm.
They did find that this support can waver when, you know, people are prompted about the financial implications and whether this could kind of cause economic issues in Ireland. But, like, by and large, the news is good, and it's very favorable compared to other EU countries. We're still much more pro-immigration than most European countries are. This, I think, will probably not come as a surprise. If you, you know, if you are someone with a social life who goes out and about and you meet people, you know, the vast majority of people in Ireland are very accepting.
Yeah.
And yeah, definitely sound, definitely helpful. Like, if I were to meet someone on the street and I were to, like, they were to express kind of anti-immigration or racist views to me, I would be shocked. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's a shocking thing to encounter.
Yeah. So I think the fact that it the turning point, or like a kind of sticking point, is the money thing, like, that is symptomatic of a society that is not appropriately caring for its citizens. That's, I don't even think that comes down to real racism. That's just about people saying, I can't get a house, I can't feed my children, I can't, you know, do whatever it is, which is a reality for lots of people in Ireland. And so therefore, it's only natural that they would look for somewhere to kind of project those frustrations.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be great if we could point them at the government. Exactly. But,
sure,
you know, if the government actually adequately cared for its citizens and resolved the housing crisis and made sure that there were not so many children living in poverty, for example, then I'm sure we would see even more improvement on these numbers.
Yeah, maybe by next week.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Okay, Carl. Well, look, best of luck with your studies today. If you want to read Carl's writing, I highly encourage that you do. It's on thejournal.ie. Particularly, check out his column, Surrealing in the Years, which comes out every Saturday and looks back on some of the more surreal events, which is basically everything in the news over the previous week at the moment.
That's true.
Carl, where can the people find you?
They can find me online and on Instagram at carl.kinsella or on Twitter at TV's Carl Kinsella.
Okay, well, look, best of luck with the academicking, and we will talk to you next week.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.